Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, folks. And it's now or never. That debt is fraud. And we need every weapon we can get. And boy, I'm telling you, folks, we need God's help. We need our Creator's help. What we need is, just like the framers, we need to call upon His favor, that He may benefit and give us the blessings. I'll just use that because they didn't use that word back then. But we need the blessings of His wisdom. And, you know, we need some miracles, and only He can do these things. But I will tell you that He can, but He won't unless we act. I mean, look at this, the miracles that He had showed Washington. These were things that, you know, Washington was just doing because it was the right thing to stand up. And there's, I believe, and as a matter of fact, welcome back, Tammy. Bringing you in sooner. I don't think I'm out on a limb when I say I believe that. Now, we got one paragraph to do of Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions, and then we go into Madison's notes on nullification. But before we do, I feel compelled to kind of speak. When we look at the macro view of the governments of Europe during, you know, the 15th or the 16th century into the 18th century, Germany broke away with Martin Luther from the Catholic domination and the Catholic Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Empire. And so they did that by educating themselves and all buying into. So in other words, it was almost a unanimous decision for all of the Germanic states to move away. When Britain decided with King Henry that same century, I believe it was in the 16th century, when King Henry said, "I want a divorce." He didn't go down the path of getting all of the people of the British Republic or these different states, and many of those states did not want to be a part of the British Isle, but, you know, they were being subjugated, and British was a pretty cruel leader, or ruler, I should say. I mean, when you look at the Tudor era, it was they didn't call Queen Mary Bloody Mary for no reason, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just like the framers didn't call Rhode Island Rogue Island with a G. I mean, there was a reason for that, because they deserved that disparaging label. Now, when we look at England and King Henry, King Henry did this for his own convenience. There were plenty of people in England that still liked Catholicism. There was, you know, there was already this beginning of religious expression, the want of free religious expression. People were becoming smart on their own and saying, "I'm not buying into what's being sold." And all of these deviations started coming out. I believe that when you really look at that 16th century, the Spirit of the Lord, after the Magna Carta, it was literally starting to pour out, and it was increasing in the hearts and minds of men. And therefore, when England or King Henry edict, because he had the power to do so, he basically said, now that we're heading towards, because they became going to be more and more powerful, I don't believe at this point they knocked off the British Empire. That hadn't happened yet. Or not the British Empire, the Spanish Armada, who at that point in time was the world empire. And so, but they were getting there, and he said, you know what, we're at a point of power where we don't need the Catholic Church anymore, and I want a divorce. So he made these demands, and Britain became a hotbed of religious persecution and religious problems. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you've got Germany that kind of all went together, and they were all they had a strong conviction for the Protestant faith. With the Anglican Church, not so. I mean, a lot of people went with it because that was where the political power and Britain was being blessed, and everybody saw these great things happening for Britain. This was a good thing. But many people were, you know, suffering or trying to deviate now that the king opened this door and people started realizing that there were problems with the Catholic Church. Right, wrong, or indifferent, British was steeped for this breakaway. I mean, this huge chasm of these factions that were causing it problems. So when they started building or creating the colonies for commercial purposes, they actually used the colonies to get rid of their problems. And two of the problems were religious problems and criminal problems. So when you look at the crime that they had in Britain because of, you know, this dissent, you know, and the Brits were a bunch of whiners. You know, they were never happy with what they had. They always had to, you know, and that's how it, but we adopted that from them, right? And so they, you know, they were discontented. They were murmurers. They were just people that, you know, they were just problems. And so one of the things that they did was they created the state of Georgia by emptying or by basically getting volunteers to come out of their penal system, their blue collar or their, not their violent crime, but, you know, hey, you want to get away and not be incarcerated anymore, you can go over to Georgia, work as an indentured service, and we will give you 10 acres of land and you can become a farmer. Yeah, I would do that. And so they basically populated Georgia by emptying their prisons, like they did with Australia.
I was going to say, yeah, like Australia.
Right. And so America was closer at that point. When America broke away, then they were forced, okay, now we really have to ship them away because we got this land that is just so available. I mean, look at Australia and the population of it. It's anyway. So all of these colonies were being created, and they were creating a real problem. And I think this was by design, whether it be by the divine hand of providence or by the king or the monarchies. They were deliberately creating these different interests of commercial interests, religious interests, and so forth throughout the colonies so that they couldn't all have a common interest. But they were doing that, one, to kind of keep the colonies in check, and two, to get rid of their problems. It was a double win for them. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
They were relishing in this, and then they started, you know, doing more and more in manipulating and, you know, waging war throughout the world and so forth. And at the same point in time, this is when they went into China and basically inflicted the opium, you know, addictions to the Chinese while they were taking their tea, and instead of paying them silver, instead of paying them cash, they did an exchange. And if you don't know the story, the emperor of China basically says, you can't do that, you have to pay us in silver. And the British, the West Indies Trading Company, which was a British company, actually went up the Ganges or whatever rivers they were, but they went up these rivers because that's where the population was in China, and with these gunboats, and they just shot up these villages and killed a bunch of people. And they said, you'll either do the exchanges or we'll just take your tea.
Wow.
They were ruthless. So, folks, just remember that when we look at how ruthless China is today, Britain taught them these things. This is why China is running fentanyl and doing very specific tactics of similar warfare to us. Because Britain taught them this. So, as we look at what Britain was doing, and I just wanted to give you the picture that they were mean SOBs. And so when we look at how the colonies were getting and developing to a point where they were actually becoming strong, Now, the Declaration of Independence points out how the king started playing and basically destabilizing the colonies by, in one instance, he actually snuck in basically spies with guns and started working with slaves in basically trying to get slaves to mount a revolution against the colony or the colonists. I mean, this is the shenanigans Britain was doing. And so these guys were not good. Oh, we look at them. Oh, look at how honorable their kings are. But look at the crap they were doing. And they still do this. So when we, you know, kind of look at how everything was going, they set the stage for themselves in waging all these wars and then saying, you know what, we need to start taxing those colonies because they're becoming too rich. And that was what broke the camel's back. That's when the colonists said, no taxation without representation. These guys were educated as well. These weren't the, you know, the people that wanted to get away back in the 1600s. No, this was now a more developed colony with some smarts. They were Englishmen, and they demanded their rights as Englishmen. And so what was basically set the stage was we created all these disparate colonies, and they, each of the colonies, I've said this before, each of the colonies had their own state-sponsored religion. In other words, the state, the government, and the religious, you know, monopoly of that state worked together. Now, they did not believe that the compassionate services should come from the hand of government. They knew that if you gave everything to the hand of government, the ones that can kill people, then they can really wage tyranny if you let them control compassionate services. So they maintained the separation between compassionate services, welfare, those types of things, from what government did. Which is why when we read the cod fishery bounties, everybody was aghast that when Madison said, hey, if we're going to start using the treasury to pay for everything, then we're going to start paying for education. We're going to start doing the compassionate services and welfare and everything else. And we'll start controlling the churches. And they were going, no, we can't do that. But he was using these things to help highlight the point that when you, just like we've been talking about, when they breached the compact, it begins to erode because they found a way through and they'll start expanding and expanding. That's what he's been pointing out here. And so this kind of helps set the stage that what we really ended up getting out of this was a nation that established for the first time in the world a true free market economy and a free, true market religion at the national level. Any state could come in and basically establish their own state based on their own religion. They even thought, many of the people even thought that there could become Mohammedan states in America. But the problem is that these people who were making those comments, like I think it was the North Carolina governor, I forget his name, but he made some comments that, yeah, eventually, maybe someday, Mohammedans will be here, you get a toehold, and may become the president. They didn't understand how things were going to transpire after the ratification, that eventually they realized the importance of the oath and that every person as a part of this government had to support the Constitution. And they didn't understand, some of these people did not understand the compulsive nature of Mohammedism or Islam and how it wants its own law. They didn't probably see this incompatibility that there could be no Islamic state in the United States because it would actually have a form of government which would be a theocracy instead of a Republican form of government based on the rule of law where the U.S. Constitution was the supreme law. Any Islamic state would become, you know, a Sharia law, and Islam would not be subjected to the Constitution. So it's not compatible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So they were talking about how great it was that the states, you know, could have all of these freedoms, but they didn't really see how the establishment, this umbrella of the federal Constitution, set the stage to actually make the states become free markets as well as free market religions. You know, free market economies and free market religion, where people could actually start deviating. Now, we've never read Madison's paragraph, or not paragraph, his essay on property. I'm going to probably do that on my own without you, but I would recommend you read that because I just want to get it in. Because we just don't, because I keep taking all this time to make these, you know, these asides, you know, creating these little foundations as we move forward. But the point that I'm bringing all of this up is that we have, when they created this Constitution, we started adopting these principles that people didn't realize in the Constitution. It put us on a path of becoming a superpower of freedom. And so, and Adam Smith talked about this, and lots of other people kind of knew that, you know, America was, you know, wow, look at the potential. But I don't think they actualized our real potential, that what freedom could really bring to America. We still, under this Constitution, folks, we still have the hope and the power and authority to take back our government and restore our freedom to a point that we, I'm telling you folks, that if we do this, we would be on a path of liberty that would actually make the world our, not our footstool, but our partner in liberty. It's not about the world serving us, it's about world being served by liberty, that everybody could enjoy the benefits of the freedom of the economy, freedom of religion, freedom of thought, and so forth. Just imagine that. We're at that point. And and now you know, Tammy, that we could literally change. This would be an epoch. This would be a new beginning of where we could actually have government do, not federal government. Now, when we talk about government, I mentioned, and I opened this door that, you know, our state government should be general governments with the provide infrastructure. The federal government should have nothing to do with that. The state governments could be doing lots of little things in supporting the the counties, where we can actually really start thriving as county economies. But we need to transition that state government into a general government. And so this is all why we have to start using petitions and understanding that the base, the foundation of power is we the people. The one thing that we ended the show with yesterday, now I'm to it. So the one thing we ended the show with was this very powerful statement. The authority of Constitution, he says, most people need to be vigilant in understanding their duty. I'm paraphrasing that. The authority, I'm now quoting, the authority of constitutions over government and the sovereignty of the people, in other words, the authority of the people over constitutions, are truths which are at all times necessary to be kept in mind. We need to constantly remember that we have the power. And at no time, perhaps, more necessary than at the present. In other words, he's pointing out that we not only have to keep this in mind, it is no more important, it is paramount that we keep this in mind now, because we're at the precipice of allowing the Constitution to be truly breached permanently with these acts. We could stop this. And they actually did by doing the coup and everything else that they did. But anyway, so let's go ahead and finish the last paragraph of the report on, or Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions. Okay?
These observations appear to form a satisfactory reply to every objection which is not founded on a misconception of the terms employed in the resolutions. There is one other, however, which may be of too much importance not to be added. It cannot be forgotten that among the arguments addressed to those who apprehended danger to liberty, well, I'm losing my place here, danger to liberty from the establishment of the general government over so great a country, the appeal was emphatically made to the intermediate existence of the state governments between the people and that government to the vigilance with which they would descry the first symptoms of usurpation and to the promptitude with which they would sound the alarm to the public.
Okay, so you're not done yet, but are you learning some, you know, he's using words that you're going, wow, impromptitude or promptitude. Wow, that's an interesting way of putting it. Okay, go ahead.
This argument was probably not without its effect, and if it was a proper one, then to recommend the establishment of a constitution, it must be a proper one now to assist in its interpretation.
Okay, so he's basically saying that this is a conversation that needed to be had, and we can't stop talking about it. There you go. He says that, you know, the parties need to start talking and chattering more and more. Bottom line, the other states have turned their backs on them. So what do you do when the other states turn their back? Well, you actually have to, because they won't see it coming, you actually have to go in because they think they're beyond reproach. They think that they're untouchable. They're sitting in a position that they can't be moved from or removed from. Folks, this is why, and when we start talking about the PR campaign of using petitions, I want you to understand that this is literally, when you start petitioning people and they turn their backs on you, they've only given you the ability to knock them down and out of office because they are obligated. We expect them to be, one, held accountable to their oath and to do the one thing that they've actually taken that oath to do, is to support the Constitution. This whole diatribe at the beginning of the show where I wandered and wandered over how the framers didn't realize what they had been given, because it all stems from that oath of office, the power of the people to assemble and petition government for the redress of grievances. And then with the 14th Amendment, the one thing that these framers in these days didn't understand, because they didn't have anything in the Constitution to actually say, you can't be in office anymore. You have now violated, by perjuring yourself, that oath, and now you're gone. You've made yourself ineligible by sayonara. They wouldn't have said sayonara, but anyway. So, very, very powerful stuff. And nobody saw this happening, but there's no doubt in my mind that as the Constitution was formed by the inspiration, by the divine hand of Providence, all these other little measures, because that little oath for them to support the Constitution became a real hook. And then all of a sudden, our ability to petition them. And they were a society and of men that would not allow their character to be impugned. They, honor meant more to them than life. They did not want to be perceived as somebody who went back on their word or they lied or that type of low standing character in society. These men were, you know, they wanted to be worthy in all capacities of serving people. So anyway, what I want to do now is I want to set the stage for this next document. So the next document we're going to cover, folks, is, and this is on the website. So all five of these documents are on the website. If you go to the academic source documents, down there we actually have these five critical documents. And I'm working on getting, because even though Tammy and I are covering these, and you can listen to these shows and go through that, we're actually doing the exact same thing with another group of patriots that are throughout pretty much the East Coast. And so these men are reading, and women, these men and women are reading these exact same documents. They're all taking turns reading the next line. So instead of Tammy being, you know, the grandstander doing all the reading and taking all the credit for reading this brilliance, these people are now sharing this, and we're actually recording that as we kind of re-dissect all of these things. Now, we're going into break, so I'm sorry I missed that, but when we come back from break, we're going to dive into the notes on nullification. This is the message that Madison had wanted the world to understand, this concept of single state nullification and how perverted it was. So we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so one of the things that I had really failed to, you know, point out is this concept of, you know, starting our campaign now, this using the petitions and, you know, doing these public relation campaigns. And so I have to emphasize, and what I need to do, you know how I say it's now or never, that debt is fraud, and we need to use every tool, you know, that we have available to us, especially spiritual tools. I need to add, your campaign begins today. Because if you begin your campaign today in holding public servants accountable, because we just finished the election, we have, this means that we run our campaign now for the next 2 years in holding these people accountable, because we know that they're not going to be supporting the Constitution. There is a good chance, folks, that we don't have to actually execute a campaign. If we start holding them accountable, like when we looked at what was happening, you know, what we did in in Washington, where there was a presentation to the Stevens County commissioners, and they actually said, you know what, we want to do this. We want to get behind this. Wouldn't that be a great problem? Instead of you having to run for that office, you know, now you can start working with them and going after your state legislature. And if you can convert them, then you don't even have to run for that office. We've already got people that are willing to do the work. Then we don't have to wait for the election. We can start today. Does that make sense? I mean, yeah, it'd be nice if you had the desire to go into office, but don't worry. Because we're going to have people in Congress that are going to need to get replaced because they're too corrupt. So that means that all these people at the state level will have to replace those people at Congress. That opens up doors for the state, for the county to go up to the state. And most times, county commissioners, they don't want to go to the state because that's a part-time job, where the county commissioner is more of a full-time job. So I'm just saying, folks, that I'm going to have to now add one more thing to my intro, that your campaign begins today. Or actually, I need to rephrase that, that your campaign begins after the latest election, because it gives you the full 2 years to start holding people accountable. If you try to hold people accountable in the last 3 months going into the election, you just become, you know, a part of the problem, because you never said anything and you never highlighted anything. Just think about it. At the beginning of the campaign, at the beginning, right after the election time, you actually start pointing out how this person did this and that was a violation of their oath. This person did this, that was a violation of their oath. You are actually creating a huge pile before the election of empirical data to prove that this person does not deserve to be reelected, and we need to replace them. And guess who becomes the odds-on favorite of replacing him? Guess, Tammy.
Yeah.
Yeah, the person that's doing the petitioning. because they say, well, we got to get rid of this person, but who do we choose? Well, you know what's going on. We need to send you. There's not a lot.
That's basically what Brent Bien has been doing.
Right. Yeah, there we go. Okay, good. And so that's what we have to do. That's what we need to do. And I know Taylor Haynes was another one that was doing that same thing. But he was really more focused on the governorship. And so I'm okay with, and I think, you know, I'm okay with promoting from within. In other words, you know, you promote your ranks from county to state, state to executive to federal or whatever. That's how the corporate world, a good corporation, builds itself, because you maintain the domain knowledge instead of bringing in, you know, autocrats or what have you, just to come in to make big changes to the company to bring up its bottom line or what have you, with, you know, constantly creating flux in your work culture and so forth. But anyway, let's dive in.
You also know who they are because you've been working with them all along.
Yeah, but they know the processes, and they're less likely to make a big mistake like, well, we're going to do this. You bring in some CEO that doesn't understand the company and actually do something that causes a problem. Okay. Because they didn't know that, I thought we could do that. It could be a problem with state law. Who knows? But let's dive into this last document. We're not going to read this entirely because this document is 14 pages as we're looking at it, and it's about almost 10,000 words. That's a lot of time. It would probably take us a couple months. This is a lot more than the Constitution. And then explaining all of these things, but the reality of this document is there's a lot of reiteration and reiteration and reiteration. And when he reiterates, he provides a little more detail to help you understand it. I would invite you to read this whole document. At least read the highlighted parts. And so even though this document is up, as we read through these, I end up highlighting it a little bit more because, that's important, right? Anyway, so the background to this was written in 1834. Madison had been out of the presidency for, almost 20 years. And Madison had really tried to retire because at that point in time, even though the judiciary was making opinions, they hadn't assumed case law and precedents to start perverting things. Even though, you know, Congress had started, you know, perverting their powers, there, you know, it was bad, but Madison basically says, okay, I'm not going to mention, you know, I'm not going to get involved. All of a sudden, the southern states, because of the abolition movement, started, you know, rising up. The southern states were, technically, Virginia was one of those states where the concept of nullification became, you know, hey, what about that? And out of North Carolina, a senator by the name of John C. Calhoun started preaching that what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison did in 1798 was nullification, where a single state could nullify federal law. Now, we're going to talk about how a single state could protect itself from federal tyranny. In other words, you are never required to allow somebody to inflict harm upon you. You can't be forced into that, nor can you be forced out of a organization. Like, let's just say you have a homeowners association and you've signed a contract, but all of a sudden you realize that some of these things in the contract are going to violate your rights. They can't force you to actually violate your rights, or they can't, you know, do things that violate your rights. So in other words, they can't force you to, you know, oh, well, we want to be a gun-free community. And they changed their bylaws to say, we're now a gun-free community, because they have a process of doing that. And you signed that you would abide by the covenants, you know, kind of like a constitution. These HOAs have that, and they make these changes. So if all of a sudden they say, well, we're going to become a gun-free HOA, or we want to dictate what you can do or what you can't do even though you signed that contract that we can dictate what you can do or can't do with or on your property, they cannot enforce that. In other words, they can't come along and say, you can't paint your house that color. You can't build your house that tall. You actually have, even though you signed that contract, they have no way of enforcing it because the states are constrained from actually coming after you to say, you don't have your own, you don't have constitutional rights because you signed that contract. That right there means that if you signed a contract that basically violated your constitutional rights, that contract is not a valid contract. So the point is this, folks, that if all of a sudden we started standing up and they said, you know, and I'm going to equate this to the state. If they come along and they say, you have to do this and we're going to enforce this and we're going to start putting liens against your property. Well, that means that they have to get the court to actually order that that can be done. That means enforcing their bogus tyranny, which means that if the court does that, then the court is actually violating, and they're violating the Constitution. Because Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says, no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities. So in enforcing, they're actually abridging your privileges and immunities. We have to be very careful we all need to clearly understand that there is no contract that you can be forced to, or you, even if you sign it by accident or willingly, they cannot enforce that in America. So the point is this, that when they realize that they can't do that, they can't kick you out. That's still your property. They can't say, well, if you're not going to do this, then you can't live here anymore. They can't do that. And it's the same thing with the states. You can't be forced out. You can't necessarily be forced into seceding under the principles, because Madison is basically stating in this document that a single state cannot nullify while staying in the Republic. However, that was only to these laws of criminal laws, not laws of violating the state's sovereignty. So it comes down to when it comes, you know, when we look at how the federal government has gone into states stealing their land, then that is not just a palpable breach. It's a breach that cannot be enforced. The problem is that the states have already allowed the bad precedents to be set, but bad precedents can always be broken. And that's the beautiful thing about the rule of law. Even though the rule of law was broken by bad precedents, the bad precedents can be broken and the rule of law can be restored. Does that make sense, Tammy? Because these are big issues for you and Wyoming.
I mean, yeah, it makes sense.
It's okay. Just, all right.
Makes sense.
Okay. So what he's talking about here in nullification was laws that were to be passed where the federal government was going to try to enforce these. Now, it's not that the states weren't not going to enforce it, but that was going to be left to the sheriffs. Could the sheriffs be forced to enforce a law that would violate the rights of the people? Now, in those days, they didn't have Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment actually makes the superior law that not even the government can create those laws to abridge those rights. And they've been doing it. But anyway, let's dive into paragraph 3, because this is where he kind of lays out this cockamamie argument of John C. Calhoun, of where he basically says that, you know, you have to have more, if as long as you have a minority of states, you know, a single state or the minority of states can nullify those. We don't have to abide by those laws. And what they're talking about is taxation laws. It's not like it's not like they're losing their property or these other rights or violating the protection of tyrannical government. The fact of the matter is what South Carolina needed to do was they needed to call upon the other states to interpose to protect them. The problem was they knew they couldn't do that because the majority of the northern states were all on board with basically taking advantage of them and hurting them. This was all over slavery. So what ended up happening with the Monroe Compromise, or not the Monroe Compromise, the Missouri Compromise, what ended up happening with the Missouri Compromise is the northern states, because the lawyers and the legal system actually got in Congress, they allowed this Missouri Compromise. Well, the state legislature said, you know, we don't want that to happen. And the state legislature and the Senate and the people of the state started changing their tune and changing their representation to say, we want you to actually end slavery and start creating these laws to do that. So that's what they were doing in to the southern states by basically waging economic warfare. Technically, they were violating the Commerce Clause. And the point is this, is they were using violations of the Constitution to wage this economic warfare against the South. But they weren't going to be willing to stop doing what they were doing because the South was doing a repugnant deed. I mean, it's not like they were coming to the table with no blood on their hands. The South was actually enslaving people, and it was became more and more apparent that this was a violation of the fundamental tenets of our Constitutional Republic, of, you know, all people were created equal, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, it became more and more of a major issue. And so the southern states said, well, we have to nullify. We're gonna stay in the Union, but we're not. And Madison said, you can't. So This whole document goes into all these details. Now you have the big picture. So let's start off with paragraph 3.
Okay. The forbidding aspect of a naked creed according to which a process instituted by a single state is to terminate in the ascendancy of a minority of 7 over a majority of 17 has led its partisans to disguise its deformity under the position that a single state may rightfully resist an unconstitutional and tyrannical law of the U.S.
Now, it's a tyrannical law that they're resisting. It's not, you know, them coming and taking from you. There's a big difference from that, because the right of defense is something, because that is waging warfare when they're taking your land and so forth. So you have a right to defend yourself and defend the Constitution. Just keep going.
Okay, hold on. I just took my eyes off and lost my spot.
It's not the highlight. Keeping out of.
Okay, keeping out of view the essential distinction between a constitutional right and the natural and universal right of resisting intolerable oppression. But the true question is whether a single state has a constitutional right to annul or suspend the operation of a law of the U.S. within its limits. The state remaining a member of the Union and admitting the Constitution to be enforced.
Okay, so again, Madison's looking at a law that's being put within the limits of the state. It's not the same as the federal government coming in and taking a large section of your land and putting a group of people in that land or on that land and saying that is now federal property and we will regulate and operate those people. In other words, they're putting a state within your state. That's a completely different type of constitutional violation. It's not just a law. It is an infliction of oppression in a different way, because they're taking from you. It's almost like cutting off your arm. They right. cannot do that. I mean, it's one thing to say, don't say that, or I'm going to slap you. But when they say, we're coming in and taking your arm from you, we're coming in and taking your legs because you have all of these trees and resources, we're making that a park.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Okay, so 4.
With a like policy, the nullifiers pass over the state of things at the date of the proceedings of Virginia and the particular doctrines and arguments to which they were opposed, without an attention to which the proceedings in this, as in other cases, may be insecure against a perverted construction.
Okay, good job. As a matter of fact, folks, one of the things that I haven't mentioned, if you're reading along, you're noticing that because this isn't a formal document, Madison takes the liberty of using abbreviations. And so he used abbreviation with Virginia. He uses abbreviation with against Congress. You're going to find in reading this, there's some parts where abbreviation, and you go, I know what these other ones are, but what's that one? And so it makes it a little bit more difficult. Not that the language isn't tough enough, but it makes it a little more difficult, especially if you don't know what the abbreviation means. But I think when you read it and you get, you basically have enough of the words that you do understand, it starts making sense, right? Okay, so with the next paragraph we're going to read is 6. So he's talking about that nullifiers are basically presenting this concept that a single state can nullify against, you know, the union by not abiding by the law, this infliction that everybody has to suffer from. But here's the question. When the federal government comes in and takes your resources from you, does that mean the entire union is suffering as well? See, when the law is passed, it is equally applied to all states. They're now isolating these states for taking these resources or doing these things. So does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
They're doing and they're isolating. In other words, these are such egregious violations that the state has the authority to defend itself. So, and as a matter of fact, the process of doing that would not be defending it in the court. The process of doing that is basically what Madison stated at the end of the Virginia report, or the report on the Virginia resolution, what we just finished. What did he say? That we have to maintain this discussion. We have to take it to the people. And so the state has to start standing up, taking it to the people and their fellow states. This becomes a new plea to say, we're defending ourselves and we expect you to honor this agreement that we're to protect each other in this union. If you have, Tammy, if you had a multiple husbands, right? And in other words, you're in a union with multiple men, and one of the men is beating up another one of your husbands. One of your husbands is beating up another husband. You know, the marriage, the members of the marriage have a right and a responsibility of holding that abusive member in check.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the union and we see an outside source that is attacking the state, that outside source being the creature you created, then it should be even more compelling for that the other states to step in and say, stop, you can't take their land. There's never been that appeal. There's never been the self-defense and appeal to say, why are you not supporting us, union, states? We are all in this together. How many states have been losing their land?
Yes.
So now we actually bring people to the table. What happens? And I believe many people in office, the reason they don't do this is because they understand that when you start challenging federal authority and realize how easy it is to get federal compliance, now that we have all of the buttons, all of the dots connected from the oath to the petition, from the oath to interposition, and the removal of public servants because of the oath of office. In other words, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the First Amendment right of petition, holding them accountable, and the holding them accountable to what? Specifically, their oath. So we can start seeing how this is all opening everything up. And this is why I believe that there are very smart politicians that realize, and I've dealt with this before, I have actually come to people and said, hey, you know, why do you have a myopic problem? Why don't we all stand together with all of our problems and actually hold the government accountable on all of that? How much more force, manpower would we have if every organization adjoined together to say, we will be united in demanding full compliance of the Constitution? Doesn't that solve your problem, your one little problem? If they start complying, that your problem goes away and everybody else goes, how is that not a win? That's a big win. then they realize, oh, well, that really solves the whole problem. And I'm better off just complaining because I can maintain my career or what I'm getting, whatever I'm making off of this. And this becomes it puts the spotlight on this whole corruption of the problem, how the problem itself is the goose that lays the golden egg, because people have realized that they can come in and complain and make money as long as you don't solve the problem. Keep that problem existing and we all make money. But eventually the problem will go away, or actually it will change because they've taken it to a new level and, you know, they've redone our government. They've remade our government. So anyway, we've covered six, right? No, we haven't covered six.
No, not okay. yet.
Now, this is interesting because he uses the word epoch. Go ahead. Because he's talking about the epoch of this concept of the resolutions that they did. Go ahead.
Okay. According to the epoch of the proceedings, the facts of the case are that Congress has passed certain acts bearing the name of the Alien and Sedition Laws, which Virginia and some other states regarded as not only dangerous in their tendency, but unconstitutional in their text, and as calling for a remedial interposition of the states.
So in other words, that's what those acts did. Those acts were calling for immediate interposition upon all the states. Go ahead.
It was found also that not only was the constitutionality of the acts vindicated by a predominant party, but that the principle was asserted at the same time that a sanction to the acts given by the supreme judicial authority of the U.S. was a bar to any interposition, whatever, on the part of the states, even in the form of a legislative declaration that the acts in question were unconstitutional.
Okay, so basically he's saying that even though the party, the Republican Party, vindicated themselves in getting the government to stop doing these things, it didn't basically take away the fact that had they gone to the judiciary would have allowed it, and it would have been a more significant loss, because not only did the states lose because the legislature passed a law, but that means that the judiciary and the executive would have gained that unconstitutional footing as well. Because as he stated in the report, when one gains, all the other two gain as well. Okay, so now we're going into seven.
Under these circumstances, the subject was taken up by Virginia in her resolutions and pursued at the ensuing session of the legislature in a comment explaining and justifying them, her main and immediate object evidently being to produce a conviction everywhere that the Constitution had been violated by the obnoxious acts, and to procure and a concurrence and a cooperation of the other states in effectuating a repeal of the acts.
Okay, so he's basically saying that we were just looking for this immediate relief, and, you know, from these acts, and all they needed was the cooperation from the other states. Go ahead. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. I didn't notice we ran out of time. So when we come back, we'll pick it up with seven. But what we're going to do, folks, is we're just going to read these paragraphs that kind of have some highlights. And then when we get to a point on the single state point where he reiterates and reiterates, we'll kind of move on, because I think all of these points need to be highlighted, but we probably won't read them all because it just take too much time. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.